Hi there, welcome to Halos of Home, a Radio Mariam podcast. My name is Serena, and on today's episode, we have Mikael. Can you introduce yourself for us very quickly, please?
Yes, my name is Mikael Arasaryan, Michael Agasarian for the Americans, and I come from Malay. I am 27 years old, and I'm happy to be here.
Mikael, the first question that I wanted to ask is, how do you define true wonder, and how does it differ from false wonder?
Oh, true wonder from false wonder. I think for me, wonder is intrinsically linked with either art or nature, preferably both. I think false wonder comes from insincerity, I want to say. I think the best definition of art I've heard is from an Armenian literary man, you could say. He worked about 50 years ago. He's no longer with us, Levon Hachverdian, and he said that art is basically the act of wonder. When we create art, we are in awe of something, and we're praising that. So for me, wonder comes from a sincere form of awe.
Do you think you need wonder to create art, though? Because you can create beautiful art and be in a very dead state of mind, I think.
I agree. I think in a weird way, it's still linked with wonder. In the absence of wonder, you could also create, if that makes sense.
Yeah.
It's funny. I think I've both been spurred to create by wonder and also by this feeling that everything's going wrong in my life. So the one thing I can do is either recreate that on a page and hopefully exorcise some demons, or maybe recreate that wonder on the page.
Is there a pressure then to make everything wonderful and beautiful?
I would say that not necessarily, not for me. I think wonder is the initial feeling. I don't think you could survive on only that. I don't know if the whole point was to talk about art. I think I've dragged it into that dead end. For me, I suppose, when creating art, or you know, even in nature, you're going to see a lot of things that are appalling. You're going to go through things that are appalling. Seeing one animal eat another is not necessarily a wondrous thing, but it's linked to the wonder that is life, without sounding too sentimental. And wonder can be terrible. I think awe can be terrible. It can be a terrible feeling sometimes. Sometimes when you're in the ocean, there's this powerful wave that will knock you over and knock the breath out of you. It's a terrible feeling, but that's an awesome use of force. And I think true wonder is when you're in the moment conscious of something. And it can be something very small. I think even just walking to this radio station, I found myself just really happy in the moment of I'm walking through this street where a year ago I wouldn't have been. And, you know, the street was unpaved. The buildings were not in a great state, but not to make it romantic, but I was very happy in that moment to be there. I felt like I could not take it for granted.
Do you see home as a wondrous thing?
Yes. Yes. I'm not sure anymore what home is. I know there are certain things that I call home.
Yeah.
And for me, those are wondrous things and wonderful things. And not necessarily things that exist anymore. So, yeah.
So it's the memory of those things?
Sure. Memory, certain places, certain people that constitute a home, I suppose, that for me are wonderful, even with all their faults. I grew up living in a two-bedroom apartment, very small, not at all bad, but, you know, there were lots of issues. We would always have a little flood, and then there were always cockroaches. But for me now, that's a very precious memory because it was a very innocent part of my life. And yeah, I think for me, it is something wonderful, that home, or home in general.
Do you think that everyone is on a journey of recovering their innocence? My friend was going through this. She's still currently trying to recover this childhood, her innocence. She feels like she's now impure because of the world, because of so many things that she's given up. Do you feel like this is something that we all go through? Of wanting to kind of reclaim the things that we've given up and have them for ourselves so that we can re-give them, but in a more pure way?
I think so.
That's a really long
question. No, because it's so funny you say that, because this is kind of crazy, but I was writing a letter today to a friend of mine I haven't spoken in a year, writing exactly that.
Really?
Seriously, I can show you the letter later.
That's crazy.
Not to the people listening to this, but I was literally writing, I feel like I've lost innocence, and I'm trying to regain that sense of joy, that sense of innocence that I associate with maybe an earlier part. I'm not that old, but but it's something that I'm actively right now searching for. So that's pretty crazy. I feel like your friend and I are on the same wavelength then. I wouldn't say I feel impure, and I wouldn't say that most people are impure. I would say that there comes a point when it feels as if life and what's happening around us is proving a point that there is no inherent maybe goodness or no inherent innocence or no inherent joy. And I think that's the struggle, is regaining that sense of innocence, regaining that sense of joy. And I know certain people who have either managed to retain it or have found it. And I think maybe wonder is a part of that. I think sometimes we lose that wonder, that sense of wonder. I mean, it doesn't take much. I mean, especially in the last alone 5 years for certain people, for me, I would say maybe certain Armenian American communities, starting with the war in Artsakh, and then, you know, with everything that followed, and then what's happening in Gaza, like everything that's happening, you're aware of that because it's what the news show more or less. You're like, oh, that's terrible. It always happens. It's been happening around the world. But for everyone, something cracks at a different time. Like there's a certain innocence that is taken or lost, and some people manage to find it. And I think that's what maybe we're all secretly trying to find, hopefully. Mm. I don't know. It's an interesting question because I was thinking about that today.
It is crazy.
Yeah.
Do you think that's this journey of regaining our innocence? Is it a concrete thing that all of us are regaining a particular type of innocence that we've given up due to age, or does it depend from person to person?
I think it might depend person to person.
Okay.
I've definitely met people for whom it feels like it's not a concern at all. And for whom it's almost as if they're dead sure that there are certain things more important than anything else. Whether it's stability, whether it's security, whether it's being right or being powerful or not being vulnerable. I think maybe for those people, the word innocence is a synonym for weakness or for frailty. In which case, for me, it's not at all about that. It is about being open, I think. But I've definitely met people with whom having this conversation would take a very different turn.
They'd be defensive around...
I think they would be dismissive.
They'd be dismissive.
And that's not to say that they're wrong. I think it comes from every person's trials. But I feel like inherently people tend to know, oh, there's something missing. People tend to recognize joy in other people.
Mm.
And their reaction tells you a lot about it. I know some people for whom another person experiencing joy for them is almost like an insult. Like, no, you shouldn't be feeling that way. No, life is terrible. They don't know how to handle joy. So
yeah.
I'm trying not to be that person.
Is it hard to not be jaded? Is this personally difficult for you?
You know, it's funny. I've even tried to be jaded sometimes. I'm like, okay, I'm done. And then the next morning, something little can make me so happy. And I sometimes feel immature in that way. Like, will I ever grow up and be a jaded adult? Like, I'm waiting for that moment. It hasn't happened. There have been times when I haven't been so much jaded as overwhelmed, or just I've become very numb. And I think that's the self-protective thing, where I become very numb and I don't want to feel anything. But I've definitely met jaded people, and they tend to feel more like they've burnt everything inside. Like it's a husk. They're a husk of a person, almost. They're saying, no, there's nothing. There's no future. There's no reason to be doing anything. I haven't reached that stage yet, and I don't think I will for a while.
Don't say yes, please.
Knock on wood, but I'm actually in a very, I want to say, life-affirming moment. Okay. Without sounding very American, but... I think moving to a different place and meeting a lot of people from different places, as we do in Birthright, is a wonderful thing, exactly because it kind of rearranges your thinking and your mindset. So I think it's hard to be jaded in Birthrighter. It's easy to be frustrated, I think, with the situation, both here and at home, wherever you call home, but maybe not jaded, yeah.
Is it art that has prevented you from becoming jaded?
Very much so. Art, relationships, I should say. Art, relationships, humor. I found humor a big saver. But definitely, especially reading books and reading those authors who you know just from reading about them that they've experienced things that you can only dream of. You read their works and you feel there's so much light in there, there's so much humor. Mm-hmm. And they could be writing about very dark things, but you sense that they're not writing that to make you depressed. They're writing it just to show you that it's okay, this too shall pass. So very much art. We went yesterday with the group to Mina Savitisyan's museum, and that for me was both very emotional because knowing his tragic history and how much was lost, and at the same time being confronted with his art. It was a very powerful moment that made me kind of realize, okay, I need to stop wasting time. I need to stop wasting so much of my time on things that don't make me happy.
How did the museum do that?
Because I realized that he left behind such a powerful statement, almost, of what he wanted, of what he loved. And I've definitely heard the saying before where there are two things you can leave behind, either children or art, or like something you've created, basically, creation. Okay. And I think for me, I've realized I spent way too much time trying to use fillers in my life, such as watching YouTube, I don't know, reading endless articles on Wikipedia. Mm-hmm. And yeah, sure, I might sound smart tomorrow because I might say, oh, this interesting little fact. But at the end of the day, I think if I'm not out looking for a wife to fulfill one of those two things, and I'm not there yet, I definitely, not should be, but I definitely want to be creating. And he inspired me with that because I think he died at 47 or something. And thank God he did what he did. And thank God so many people do what they do. That is inspiring. Whether they die young or old. So I'd rather be part of that team than the jaded kind of cynics. I don't know. I don't want to disparage them either. We need them as well. Yeah.
What do you want to start creating? I know that you like to write.
Very much.
Are you trying to write more?
Yes, actually. I don't know if you've ever had this. Probably, actually. Like, there are certain characters or certain stories that have been in my head for so long. At this point, I think they've given up on me. Because they used to at least insult me, like, get up, do something, we want to be out already. And now they're kind of like, okay, you know what, we've given up on you. And I'm hoping they haven't truly, because I'm hoping I'll be able to sit down and they're still alive enough. But I kind of get in my head sometimes about that. But there are definitely stories I want to write. And it almost feels like I want to write to just, not rid myself, but get them out, get them breathing.
Yeah.
Or else it feels like I'm a murderer half the time. I'm like, wow, that's not fair to them.
Does that connect with home for you? Even when it comes to retelling your own life, do you feel this need to retell your own stories, or is it more so inventing new ones?
That too. It's an interesting thing. I think the one story I would struggle with the most is the one where there's a character very similar to me. Mm. All the other stories are about either people I know or people I've made up. There's always something born out of my experience, but I think it's more interesting for me to delve into the head of someone else.
Yeah.
And to find their stories. I'm right now reading a modern Armenian novel by a young writer. And there are some laudable things, but a lot of the issues I'm finding in his writing, I realize that I do with myself. Mm-hmm. So these very long lyrical passages that don't really tell the story, or about his obsessions, but there's no interesting character development or anything. Mm. You know, it's a young writer. It's a forgivable error, forgivable fault. But like, I read my own writing, and the only time I like my writing is when I'm writing about other people. A simple little story. It doesn't have to be deep or anything, but it's just more or less well-written, interesting, hopefully humorous. Mm. And with home, I've always been a little obsessed with writing. And I haven't really written anything yet, so I don't think it's fair to even say I'm obsessed with it. But I always keep going back to my parents and even their generation. And I've even thought about not writing so much about my childhood as writing about what my parents went through as new immigrants. They're always new. As immigrants, young immigrants, and the crazy stuff they went through. And even before that, their childhood in Yerevan, in the Soviet Union. And that for me is much more interesting than, okay, so I went to high school and here's what happened. But even that, I think there are a lot of stories I went through that I would be more interested in recasting. But what actually happened, I think, is worth telling, whether it's loss of innocence. There was a time when I was sure I was going to go mad at one point, because I would every night just pace in my room for like 2-3 hours, just obsessing over the same thing. Mm. And it had to do with Armenia and with Azerbaijan and the war. And I was just going crazy slowly. And thankfully, I didn't go crazy. But I realized that if I were to write a character, it'd be interesting to write about a character who goes through that and to see what happens if they didn't get out of it. What happens when you become so negative and so full of hate that that's all you become? So yeah, lots of little interesting stories.
Can you understand what your parents went through? Are you able to communicate with them and they share the whole truth, or are there aspects that are so traumatic that it's not talked about?
Both. My mother's definitely much more, she's like me, we talk a lot. We'll talk a lot with each other. She's definitely shared a lot about her experiences and even about my dad's experiences. My dad's a little more closed. Like a lot of Armenians, his 20s were rather traumatic, and it's not that he refuses to talk about it. You know, whenever there's a fun memory, whenever there's a funny memory, he gladly shares it with us. And you can feel the love, the fun, or the fun. Yeah, the love. But whenever it goes to something that's close to the trauma you went through, that's when it kind of shuts off. But that in itself, for me, is a form of communication. And for me, I wouldn't want to write directly about them, but I think that for me is more interesting. Mm. Because I think that resonates with me. And I think that's something I've not yet read, maybe.
Mm.
And or if I have read it, maybe not in an Armenian context.
Mm.
So that would be interesting for me. And at the end of the day, if I don't like it, I can always burn it. So
yeah,
it's worth a try.
Yeah, I think it's true that there is so much to be said in what is not said, what's not mm-hmm. talked about.
Yeah. Which, you know, me being very talkative sometimes, I can learn from that, maybe.
And I want to ask, I believe you're an actor. Is that right?
I trained to be one. When I graduated, I realized that's not for me. So,
really?
Yeah. So now, I'm not sure what I can call myself, but I'm living right now.
How does this relate to maybe the stories of your parents?
Mm.
Is it a similar thing when you're acting, trying to tap into another character, understanding their story? I guess the similarities.
Yeah. I think when I was training to be an actor, I wasn't very good. I think because I was either in my head or I didn't have an experience. Now I think if I were to try acting, I still have to work very hard, but I think there would be certain things I'd tap into more easily, which I think are connected with maybe becoming more intimate with my parents' story or with just, you know, the crazy years we've all had in the last 5 years. I think I would be able to be more open and sincere in my acting, which was something that was lacking before. Yeah.
Okay. What made you do acting in the first place?
I loved the theater. I didn't go to the theater that often when I was little. So when I went the first couple of times, it was a big thing for me. I was kind of like, whoa, what is this? This is so great. And when I was little, I could never decide what I wanted to be. So being an actor felt like a good choice because you could be someone else every time you go on stage. And I love to read a lot. So I read a lot of biographies of actors and autobiographies. So I was always in this world. And now looking back, I realized that I think what drew me the most was the stories. And I would even enjoy more reading the play or finding out about the writer or seeing the behind the stage process than necessarily the acting itself. But I mean, I definitely recommend everyone to try acting once. Doesn't matter the age, just try. It is one of the highs of my life. Yeah. You're on stage and there's this thrill that goes through you. It's half fear, but also half elation. And when you're in the moment with another actor and you're performing something, you're simultaneously in your body and you're outside of your body and the audience is there with you. It's a magical feeling. It's something that I've experienced maybe twice, three times in all of the years I devoted myself to acting or went to school for acting. And those moments were just magical. And it's really hard to recreate that outside of maybe the theater. Yeah.
Is it hard to be yourself when you're training as an actor? That's how I would feel. I'd feel disconnected from myself.
I think it was, and therefore that's why I wasn't as good as I would have hoped to have been. Because I think the whole point is that you're not disconnected from yourself. You're very much yourself, more so yourself. I think with me, it's always been an issue where I'm very good at putting on a mask. And I thought that, oh, that's good for acting. And I think on the contrary, that's very not good for acting. Because a person can immediately tell when someone else is pretending or playing a game.
Do you think so? People can be really deceptive.
That is also true. So I hope that I am right in saying that most people can tell. Or I hope I'm lousy enough so that people can tell if I'm putting on a mask or playing games. Not that I do it all the time. But I find it's very hard for me to sometimes be emotionally open.
Really?
I don't know how to explain this. I'm very good at it and I'm very bad at it at the same time. I'm very good to emotionally go somewhere with someone. So if someone confesses something, I can be there with them emotionally very well.
Yeah.
But I'm not good at...
You're not good at being the one who's receiving the support?
Maybe. Maybe. I don't know. I also think too much, and that could be also a problem. I sometimes overthink. Yeah, it's an interesting thing. I had two friends. One friend was like me, where we could be talking about something very tragic and feel like we're both acting a little bit.
Huh.
Like, oh, we should be feeling a little down. I don't know how to explain it. And then there's someone, another friend of mine, who is so full of emotion, who is so full of heart. It's very hard for him to open up, because when he does, it just floods out.
Yeah.
And for me, it's very open to emotionally go somewhere, but sometimes it doesn't feel as real because it's like, oh, I'm not really struggling. And therefore, maybe it's not real. I don't know.
I wanted to ask if that connects with masculinity, but maybe not if your friend, every time he opens up, it's a floodgate for him.
No, I think it is related to masculinity.
You think so?
It's very rare that he opens up.
Okay.
Yeah. You know, it's funny. I think for me, I can definitely talk from my experience. I feel very different living here in Armenia than I do in America. And both in America and in Armenia, there are different role models of what masculinity is.
Or how should are they be. Different? Could you explain them?
There's like four or five models here and four or five models in America. I can contrast some of them. The most kind of toxic popular one in America is never cry. Your woman should be in the kitchen, barefoot and pregnant, whatever, whatever. You know, that's recognizably toxic. There's also the other one where, oh, there's no difference whatsoever between a man and a woman. None whatsoever. Basically, the only difference is a few physical details.
Yeah.
So that's the other kind of extreme. And then most people, if we're being honest, kind of fall in the middle.
Yeah.
Here, there are still more kind of defining differences between men and women. Especially if you go to Yerevan. I always like to make this joke. If you see a woman on the street walking, right? She's always walking with a purpose. She's either going home after a long day's work or she's, you know, almost running to work. They're always active and moving. And most guys are just taking their sweet time. Not all of them. There are working men. But like, there's a sense that, you know, especially now, every time I go somewhere to a workplace, it's usually women and it's usually young women. You know, that's something that's changed. And that's something that was also part of the reality. Both my great grandparents were both engineers in the Soviet Union. I believe both of them received more or less the same pay. The difference was when they would come home, mostly the great-grandmother would be doing most of the house chores, cleaning most of the things. The great-grandfather would do a little less of that. But maybe there was something else he did more. He was in the war, for instance. So it's hard to sometimes tell, okay, who's doing more and less. For me, being here, I do feel more like a man here in a positive way. I feel more self-confident. I feel more, not just a man in terms of my relationship with women, but a man in relationship with other men.
Yeah.
I feel like here there's a sense of more brotherhood, maybe, with men. And there's a sense that you can both rely on someone more here and at the same time know that let's be strong for each other. I think oftentimes in America you hear be strong, but it's not clear for what. And I'm not sure how it is in Australia. But here, there's a lot of toxic role models here too, undoubtedly. But I think for me, I'm hopefully developing a positive masculinity where there are certain things that for me feel right, you know. The best example I'll put is this. When we play soccer, which you should come and play sometime. Whenever we play soccer, there is a big difference between when there are some girls playing with the guys and when there are no girls. And it's not at all worse or, oh, the guys are like unhappy. No, it's actually sometimes even more fun with the girls. If only because we make them the defenders and then the other guys can't really get too crazy. And it's like, great, we're going to win this time. And the girls tend to play with just as much nerve and they're doing great. And that's a lot of fun. But what I've noticed is when there are no girls, all of a sudden, okay, hats off. Not hats off, gloves off. Like, it gets a little ferocious. All the cussing starts right about then. People are still upset when they lose and there are girls playing. If you're a devoted football player, it doesn't matter who you're playing with or against. If you lose, you're angry. But when there's just guys, you can tell, okay, now we can just beat each other up and we're not going to feel bad about it. I was talking to one of our female volunteers about that and she's like, yeah, but why? And I was like, I can't explain it. Even for me, that's true. If I'm playing against a girl, I'm not trying any less. I'm just, it's a little different. For me, that's okay. I've noticed it with the older generation here. I went to a gathering here. My parents' friends are here in town. And they're all in their 40s, 50s, 60s. So anytime a new couple would arrive, all the men and all the women would just separate. The women were in their corner. The men are in this corner. And in America, it tends to be all together at this point, especially outside of the Armenian community. All the men and women are together. There's nothing wrong with either one, but I've noticed that here, the women enjoy being with the women more, and the men enjoy being with the men more. You're allowed to relax in that group in a way that you maybe can't relax when it's intermingled. I don't know if that's the right word. I'm not sure if in America you could say the same. I think in America, we're bred more to feel comfortable about everyone. There are some positives and negatives with that. I think sometimes in America, we overdo it where guys feel 100% comfortable saying anything in front of the girls and vice versa. And it's only in hindsight you realize, oh, that was a step too far. And that actually resulted in maybe hurt feelings. there is still a difference, and we sometimes overlook that difference. On the other hand, here, that can be taken to an extreme. Yeah. And I've definitely had those moments where I'm like, okay, here's a bright girl who feels that she can't say anything because, oh, no, no, I need to be quiet. Mm-hmm. Thankfully, it's much less than I assumed before. But there are still those moments where I'm like, okay, her social cues still tell her that she needs to be a little less imposing. So my job as a theater instructor here is to get them to just be loud and to yell. And they keep coming back. So hopefully that means it's helping them. Mm. Yeah. So I'm not sure if I answered what masculinity is, but it's hard to define. But I think I tend to recognize true masculinity. And it oftentimes has very little to do with, oh, what is a man? Like, if you're respectful towards both women and men, that for me is already a good thing about masculinity, as it is about femininity.
Could you talk a little bit about where you grew up? I believe it is Sherman Oaks.
Yes, Sherman Oaks, which is a really small neighborhood in Los Angeles.
Okay, is it Armenian neighborhood?
It's become more Armenian, yeah. I used to joke that when my parents moved there, because I was born there, we were the only Armenian family, but I think even then there were some other ones.
Hmm.
It's become recognizably more Armenian. There's now a few Armenian stores.
Okay.
Yeah, it's definitely become more Armenian. It's nowhere near Glendale or even Burbank, which I'm happy about. We don't need to be. We can be a very quiet, small community.
Yeah.
And by community, I mean like there's just Armenian families there. I've never been part of a community get together. You know, it's a small, really quiet part of town. It's become a little more sketchy, sadly, over the last couple of years, especially after COVID. Crime rose for a while. There was a huge issue with homelessness. But, you know, Sherman Oaks is one of those places where if you're driving from one end of the valley, if you take a nap for 5 minutes, you will have passed Sherman Oaks without knowing. So, you know, it's hard to differentiate it from other places.
Does it feel like home to you?
Yes, very much so. It feels like home. I love to walk a lot. I've walked nearly through all the streets in Sherman Oaks. There's a Trader Joe's, which is a grocery store for those who don't know, which I don't know why, but it's a big part of my life or childhood, rather. We would go to that store. It's not even that special of a store, but for me, it was always the walk to the store with my mom and my brother, and we would buy something. There's a lot of, so to speak, landmarks throughout Sherman Oaks that for me are very precious. It's still a home, yeah.
And what was it like growing up in an Armenian family? In Sherman Oaks, in the States.
Yeah. I think my, so to speak, Armenian family is very different from a lot of, I mean, we're all different. But I never felt growing up that, oh, we're Armenian.
You didn't? Even with Hayastansi parents?
No. It was just a fact. Like, we're Armenian. I grew up in a melting pot, you could almost say. And not like the American melting pot, but like in our courtyard. Thankfully, we had a courtyard. So thankfully, as a child, I was able to run outside, play with friends. You could hear everything. Armenian, Russian, Spanish, English. It always felt like, oh, yeah, we're just one more cool ethnicity or something. And oftentimes, actually, I grew up listening to Armenian songs, for instance, by Ruben Khachverdyan. And for me, it didn't feel like, oh, this is what makes us Armenian. No, it's just something I loved. And my parents, thankfully, never forced on either me or my brother anything that felt like, you're Armenian, therefore. Mm-hmm. So we were never forced to go to church. We were never forced to go to Armenian celebrations. There wasn't a negative to that. It was just for a long time. I think for me and my brother, for us being Armenian, was just, okay, yeah, we're Armenian. And I didn't even know really about the genocide in depth until maybe high school.
Mm.
And again, I'm very grateful. My parents didn't put any baggage on me and my brother. And I once asked my mom, like, we didn't really speak Armenian. And they're both fluent. They would always speak it at home. But me and my brother knew at one point more Russian because it was the Soviet Union influence. You know, you had Russian animation films, which were great, and Russian children's books. And at one point, I was like, how were you not worried? It was possible for me and my brother to never care about Armenia or never care about being Armenian.
Yeah.
And she's like, you know, I somehow never had that worry. She's like, I knew that you two would fall in love with Armenia and not so much being Armenian, but just those things that are Armenian that would resonate for you. And what they did do, which I'm so grateful, is that they never saved for a house. What they did was they would use whatever money they could to take us to Armenia. Before Birthright Armenia, I think I've been to Armenia maybe 7 times. And for me, that is when I started going, oh, this is Armenia. Oh, I come from this place. Oh, my parents' memories take place in this city. Because for me, Yerevan was always this rose-colored, mythical city that's very beautiful. The first time we came here, it was full of dust and people were kind of with angry faces walking around. And I was like, oh, okay, this is different. But at the same time, oh, these churches are magnificent. After the fifth church, I did get tired. You do get tired after the fifth church when you're touring, but it was still a very magical experience. And every time we'd come, something new would open up for me. So no, I wouldn't say I grew up in an Armenian, and I'm doing quotation marks here, Armenian family. I just grew up in a very wonderful family where my parents, especially, they're a little crazy in a good way. They love art. My dad's favorite artists are Michelangelo and music like Stevie Wonder. It doesn't matter where the art comes from, whether it's music or anything, they love it. I remember my favorite visual artist was Hokusai, the Japanese one who did the famous wave, but there's so much more because I would have these big books in my house. And so for me, that was always much more interesting and vibrant. And so therefore, when I came to Armenia, or when I discovered Armenianness, for me, it was like, okay, what do we have that's so wonderful? Oh, that's great. And I fell in love with that. And in my case, it was the literature and also the memories and the people here. So me speaking Armenian, that happened very late, fluently, very, very late. I was 21 when I started reading. I didn't know the alphabet before that. Learning the history came very late. But now I'm grateful that that's the path I had to take. And there was never a feeling from my parents that being Armenian is not a good thing. They were just more intent on making sure me and my brother were good people and then good Armenians, whatever that means.
I think if I contrast that with myself, it does feel like I have baggage from my Armenianness.
Yes.
Because I grew up very much that we have to stick together, that you are Armenian. This was so drawn out as a huge part of my identity. We've talked before how I've said that the language is a little bit difficult for me in terms of traumatic experiences that I've had surrounding the language, and it makes it a little hard for me to be open towards learning and advancing my Armenian, and how it feels different to if it was a totally new language. And I'm wondering, is there any baggage that comes with being Armenian for you, or is it pretty much a blank slate given that you learned all of this information a little later than myself, and you weren't fed the same narrative that I was fed throughout my whole childhood?
That sounds terrifying. And I'm sure it was done with good intentions, but you know, sometimes that can have a worse effect. So for instance, you were talking about how for you the Armenian language itself has such a negative connotation for you.
Not only negative, but there is a very looming presence of negativity.
And that's fair. And hey, this goes out to all, especially diasporan Armenians who from, you know, day one, what they hear is Amot, hayran chigites. Amot, like you need to go learn it. Oh my goodness, yes. I heard it from relatives here sometimes, very whispered. You could hear it in their tone, like, oh, you don't know Armenian. And thankfully at that time, I really couldn't care less. I was like, hey, I want to go to London and be an actor. I really couldn't care less if I knew Armenian. I think what's admirable for you is to come to Armenia and be a volunteer when you have such baggage. And hopefully that's helped you. I remember we were talking with the founder of Birthright Armenia, and you brought this concern with her. And she said, you know what? It doesn't matter if you never speak Armenian ever again. What matters is that you came and you saw. And that means that something is now inside you that wasn't before. You know, I think those words are very true. I'm a language freak. I love the Armenian language. I would love it if everyone learned it, not just Armenians. But at the same time, I think what matters more is to have a healthy relationship in whatever form with that part of your life. I don't even like calling it Armenia or Armenianism. I like just with that part of your life in whatever form it is. If that form is what you're doing now, that's fantastic. I personally, my baggage with being Armenian is the baggage we all carry.
The genocide.
The genocide. And on top of that, I think, and again, I'm going to paraphrase a writer I very much love, an Armenian writer, Hrant Matevosyan. He once made the observation, it was either him or some other genius, that the issue with Armenians, especially after the genocide, but kind of ever since maybe the fall of the last state we had, was that we have such a rich, such an enormous culture, such an enormous inheritance, but we're so few that it's so hard to carry it all. We're so few that, you know, we need at least like 5,000 experts and specialists to uncover how rich our culture was and how rich our culture could be. But, you know, we barely have experts or specialists in any field, especially here in Armenia. It's the huge loss. And it's a loss that's not in any way becoming a scar because it keeps happening. You know, we lost Artsakh. And the thing with Armenians is that we tend to be a little nihilistic. Oh, we lost it and that's it. Azerbaijan lost what they call theirs 30 years ago. And yeah, I'm sure there were people in Azerbaijan who were like, okay, and that's it. We're never going to see that again. And then there were the ones who were like, okay, no, in 30 years, it's going to be ours again. So I think with us Armenians, we tend to fixate on our negatives. We fixate on our faults. We fixate on this sense of like, oh, it's meant to be in a negative way. I think, no, it really matters what we do here and now. But there's just no getting around it. The genocide, the loss. There's a funny sketch on YouTube. It's an Irish sketch group. They did a sketch where any issues in Ireland, they always say, it's the British. Like, it could be anything. And I think with the Armenians, unfortunately, so much of it is, oh, the genocide. Oh, the genocide. And unfortunately, it is that horrific of a thing. So yeah, that's the baggage. And in my case, I didn't grow up with that baggage. I think at one point I cursed myself for learning Armenian. I'm like, I could have lived my life happily just knowing there wasn't genocide. I don't really care. I could be in London. I don't know why it's always London. I could be in New York. I could have been like this and that and that. But instead I went and did a stupid thing. I learned the language. I fell in love with all these writers. And it turns out half of them died in the genocide. I felt self-inflicted, but it had to happen. Not the genocide. Me going through this, which is very small compared to other people's experiences.
There was something you said just then. Maybe we can use this as a closing,
yes,
open-ended re-quotes. And you said that it's not even a scar because it keeps happening.
Mm-hmm.
The fact that Armenians are still being persecuted. I just found that really beautiful.